Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to The Conservative Cauldron, Bewitching Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town, to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long.
Good morning and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Welcome to the Monday edition of our program. Welcome, Internet world. I hope this is going to be a great week for you. I think the summer temperatures are starting to escalate and it starts to feel a little bit more like summer. Hope your 4th of July weekend was good. I know, back to work for most of us. That is the sad reality of life, but we're all grateful that we are employed. I have some statistics I want to just read to you for a couple of minutes, and this is in light of the program we're going to have later on. There are approximately 3,000 honor attacks in the UK every year. 6,000 girls and women are circumcised every day, according to the United Nations. There are 5,000 reported honor killings worldwide every year, and more than 60 million girls worldwide are child brides. Now, I don't like to just trump out statistics just to trump them out. These are there for a reason. At 10 a.m. today, in just about 25 minutes, I have a very special guest on The Cross in the Desert. Her name is Zainab Khan. She is a licensed clinical therapist for survivors of domestic violence, primarily among the South Asian community. She's also activist for global women's rights through education and awareness. And she was featured just recently in the powerful documentary film, Honor Diaries. Besides that, she's a very good, talented artist and does fascinating paintings and artwork. We're going to talk to her at 10 today, and we're going to talk about her involvement with survivors of domestic violence and what she does as a speaker and a lecturer to educate and empower women who have suffered in some of these categories that have gone through deplorable psychological and physical atrocities committed against them. One of the things I found just fascinating from Nazanin Afshin-Jam, who was my guest this past weekend, she says, from a time a child is born, if you're a girl, you do not have the same opportunities as your male counterparts. It's amazing how women are treated by the male population, and we're going to do something about that today. We're going to educate you and bring awareness to you because this is a very life and death issue, and Zainab is very aware of this, and she's very knowledgeable, and I can't wait to talk to her at the 10 o'clock hour. Well, before we get into the whole subject of honor diaries and what that's all about and domestic violence and honor killings and the things that are associated with, I want to bring us up to date with what's going on in the Middle East. Just this past weekend on Fox News, Lisa Daftari, who is the Middle East journalist, brought us up to date on what's happening with ISIS. So we're going to hear about it right now on the cross in the desert.
And for more on the threat posed by the Sunni terrorist group ISIS, we're joined by Lisa Deftari, a Middle East journalist and Fox News contributor. Lisa, I want to start with this. ISIS is becoming more of a state actor than it is just a discrete group running around parts of Syria and Iraq. What is the threat to America posed by this? Forget what's happening in the Middle East. How does this affect folks at home?
Towards national security. I mean, we're seeing that this is jihad 2.0. They're not afraid to get their message out there, to use social media, to be on Facebook, to put out videos and to put out rap videos and to recruit. And we already know that thousands of Americans and people from the UK and Canadians are out in Syria, in Iraq. They're volunteering themselves. I mean, these are American passports, so you think about airport security. I mean, these are people who have vast knowledge of bomb making, of the internet, of using all of these different platforms. And you have to look at what ISIS's agenda is. It's not only to take over Iraq, it's to build this caliphate, which they told us last week. It's to impose Sharia law, which they told us this week. And they're going really step by step as to what we thought they would do. What's the next step? Get rid of American influence in the region. And what's the step after that? To then start launching attacks from this caliphate.
So it seems like it's worth taking these folks at face value when they say their threats are continuing to do what they say they're going to do almost week by week, fulfilling these promises. What do you make from this picture? This is a picture we cannot confirm, but it appears to be Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, showing up in Mosul. What does it say that he's now willing to be seen in Iraq in public?
Right. So look at the audacity, right? And the fact that they haven't verified the video yet, and we're going to be careful and say that we're still going to wait for that confirmation. But the point is, they haven't been shy about putting their agenda out there up to this point. So why shouldn't we believe that now he would make this video and come out and put his statement out there? We saw the same thing from Boko Haram. They made a video. So these jihadists are not hiding anymore in these caves in Saudi Arabia. They're not hiding in Pakistan. This is new school jihad.
And probably the fact that we have some pictures of some of the shrines, especially the Shia shrines, all throughout Iraq, and is this split is happening between the Sunni and Shia there that's turning into what can be certainly called a civil war. They are not afraid of putting these pictures up, showing what they're doing. That has to really fan the flames that are already pretty hot.
And we saw this before where extremists are burning down and using bulldozers to take down religious sites. And they did it before with the churches in the region to marginalize the Christians. And now the Shiites are doing it to the Sunnis, and the Sunnis are doing it to the Shiites as a symbolic move. And they're not afraid of putting these very, very graphic pictures to those who obviously find these sites to be holy to them.
Zoom out for us in a minute and sort of give us this Sunni-Shia split that is happening right now in the Middle East. You have Iran who supports Nour al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq. You, on the other hand, have these Sunni groups, and you have a proxy war being raged right now. How does this spread and affect the rest of the world as it goes on?
Well, they both are vying for influence, right? So whether you have Saudi Arabia wanting the Sunni influence and you have Iran wanting the Shia influence, we saw that. This started more so in Syria, and now it's bleeding over into Iraq. I mean, we're coming into this at the middle of the movie, if not even closer to the end of the movie. What was going on for a very long time, as you said, Leland, is this proxy war, and they're not cities, even though they're going city by city, and ISIS very strategically started in the north with their Sunni constituencies and are coming down into the Shia areas. They're after influence. They're after this caliphate, and they want to spread Sharia law and their Sunni influence.
And that is the alleged picture of the leader there, as you pointed out, there in Mosul giving a speech. And you have to think in terms of taking this guy at face value as what he says that he wants to do, because that's what they have been doing all the way over the past year. So Lisa Deftari, really appreciate you coming in. As bleak as the picture it is good to get that view of it. All right, Lisa, thank you very much. Arcel?
Thank you to you and
Elisa
as well.
Lisa Deftari on Fox News this past weekend, educating us, bringing us up to date on the situation going on in Iraq as ISIS continues to spread violence. There are reports that they are raping women. These are the subjects we're going to be talking about in just the next few minutes. I think one of the most important things we can talk about is the violence that is committed in the name of twisted religion, in the name of patriarchal norms. These kinds of violence end up called honor violence. You may say, what on earth are you talking about? What is honor violence? Well, it's a violence against an individual who has dishonored their family, according to them. And most victims of honor violence are targeted because their behavior violates cultural or religious norms. And the way this is defined, and I got this from the Honor Violence fact sheet on honordiaries.com, the assailant in an honor violence crime feels that the only way to restore the family honor is to harm or kill the victim. Victims are often, as you hear in the news, shot, stoned, burned, buried alive, strangled, smothered, and stabbed in the name of restoring honor. Honor is more important in these norms, in these families, than life itself. And just as an example of this, this past weekend, about a month ago, I did a whole program about Farzana Parveen, a young Pakistani girl who decided to go against the family norm, if you will, the family mandate, and marry another man that was not chosen for her. As a result of it, to make a long story short, she was targeted by her family and publicly stoned in Lahore, Pakistan. Just an awful, awful, atrocious crime. Well, just this past weekend, a teenage girl died in Pakistan after being doused in petrol and set on fire by a man who wanted to marry her, but whose proposal had been rejected. This is what the police reported. It's just awful. It's the second brutal killing in Pakistan's Punjab province within days. And before I mention to you about Farzana Parveen, this incident took place in a village which is part of Toba Tek Singh Town. The victim, Sidra Sakayat, 18, was at home without her parents when this 22-year-old man entered her home, doused her with petrol, and set her alight. She was taken to a local hospital, which referred her to the main hospital before she died reaching there. And, of course, Islam has been arrested in the case, registered again. But the problem in Pakistan, the problem in Lahore, is getting laws changed, is getting a punishment for these crimes. The boy loved her, it says, and had also sent a proposal to marry her, but that was rejected by her family. It's amazing, these things. We're going to be talking about this. Zainab is going to really educate us about what's going on in the world. And one of the ways that this problem is being attacked in a very powerful way is through the documentary Honor Diaries. We are going to listen to a clip. This is actually from TV2 Africa, and we're going to hear from the actual director of Honor Diaries, too, in this clip. I want you to hear a little mini documentary about what we're going to talk about later. So just to prepare you for what's to come, we're going to hear about a small documentary from Honor Diaries right now. On the cross in the desert.
Thousands of women and girls worldwide are subjected to forced marriage, mutilation, attacks, and even murder, all in the name of honor. A new documentary called Honor Diaries shines a spotlight on this perversive problem. Tabita Naim has the story.
Female genital cutting. Most commonly done before puberty, some young girls will have their clitoris completely removed to preserve their virginity.
I'm a survivor of FGM. I went through FGM when I was a week old.
Jaha Dukore, a young Muslim woman originally from Gambia, is a survivor of female genital mutilation and child marriage. She believes that what she went through is not required by her Islamic faith. Yet FGM, as it is called, is practiced in more than 20 countries, many of them Muslim, around Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. It also takes place in some immigrant Muslim communities, even in the United States.
Whenever you have immigrants that migrate from other countries, they bring their cultures and their traditions with them. People don't know that it happens. That's why it's easy it happens, because when it happens and no one really talks about it, the way we can change attitudes in the United States is by raising awareness, getting more people involved, getting the government involved, providing support services for these girls, giving them hope and giving them, you know, letting them know that people really do care.
The injustice that Jaha Dukure speaks out against is one of many human rights abuses committed against women in the name of honor, which are highlighted in a recently released documentary, Honor Diaries. Paula Queskin is the producer of Honor Diaries and also a human rights lawyer.
This is not an issue that people want to talk about. This is an issue that is swept under the rug time and time again. There is a paralyzing sense of political correctness, not only in the United States, but in many countries around the world, where they feel that if they're talking about issues such as violence against women that are sometimes condoned by culture or religion, then they're not allowed to talk about it. And that's primarily and specifically why we should be talking about it.
My sister, Rubina, was telling me how unhappy she was in her marriage. And I said to her, come to me. And she said, I can't, because I have to think about honor. She didn't want to dishonor the family by leaving her husband and divorcing him. But my sister, in the end, took her own life. She set herself on fire. Rubina did, and she died.
The documentary was a joint effort by 30 women's rights groups. Question says Honor Diaries is more than a movie. It is a movement to engage people all over the world.
We want to have the film translated and shown all over the Muslim world. We've translated the film into Arabic, Farsi, Urdu, and we hope to have it shown and distributed as widely as possible. We're also raising monies to hopefully enact a text line and helpline here in the United States that could potentially serve as a refuge for women and girls at risk of these issues.
For bringing shame to the family, her own husband cut off her nose and ears.
Muzamil Hassan is accused of beheading his wife after she filed for divorce.
And allegedly run down by her own father for becoming too westernized.
The murder was seen as an honor killing.
The producers hope the documentary will help more people break the silence and open an honest dialogue on the issue of violence against women, which they say is the first step to promote change. Tabinda Naim, Voice of America, Washington.
Well, there you have it, just a mini documentary, just a little taste of what is to come in the next few minutes. Honor Diaries has had its share of controversy. The CARE organization, the Council on Islamic Relations, has used the term, which we hear a lot of, Islamophobia. And that's a way to silence, to cut off the conversation. But that's not the answer. There may be controversy from Muslims, and of course this is not just limited to Muslim countries at all. But the point I'm trying to make is we need to have dialogue. We need to have constructive dialogue. We need to talk these issues through and take action. Laws need to be changed. Things need to be done, and women need to be freed from these egregious violence killings, and especially the way they are limited to their potential. It's a crime. It's a crime against humanity. And another thing I found interesting about this subject, which I'm sure we'll talk about with Zainab a little bit later, was the idea that this is not just limited to women, to an issue with women. It's a men's issue as well. And I'm hoping that a lot of men will respond to watching this. I hope this is not just gender-based for women to watch this video. I hope many, many men will come to the lectures, will come to the screenings, and participate, because I think that's what we have to do. We have to reach out to the men as well and educate them, because this is an ongoing terrible problem that something must be done about. What I want to do right now is help us to understand a little bit more about some of the things that are going on that are related to Honor Diaries. And just recently, Nana Darwish and Zainab Khan, my live guest in a few minutes, were on Sean Hannity in Fox just back in May and had a little panel discussion about women sharing stories of experiences under Sharia law. We're going to hear that right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Welcome back to Hannity. Now, for years on this very program, we've been sounding the alarm about the horrors of Sharia law, and tonight I want to clarify in very simple terms exactly what Sharia is and what some of the punishments are for their so-called crimes. Now, under Sharia law, adultery, homosexuality, that's punishable by death, as are false accusations of rape. In many countries, you need, if you're a woman, 4 male eyewitnesses to prove it. Honor killings are allowed, meaning that murder is permissible if someone is deemed to dishonor their family, their husband, etc. If someone steals something, guess what? Their hands cut off. Punishments for other crimes include beheadings, flogging, women beaten, stoned to death. And here now, with insight on Sharia law from Arabs for Israel, Nani Darwash is with us, and a women's rights activist who was featured in the Honor Diaries. Zainab Khan is both here. Guys, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. Nani, you grew up in Cairo. You grew up under Sharia. Is that an accurate description?
Absolutely. And the problem with Sharia, it's not necessarily enforced by government. It can be enforced by anybody on the street.
By men.
By men. There are murders allowed under Sharia. Murdering an apostate is one of them. Anybody on.
You mean apostate meaning somebody who believed in Islam and then converts to Christianity.
An adulterous woman.
No.
Her father, her brother, her husband can kill her.
How many wives can some of these men have?
Up to four wives. The marriage contract under Sharia is different from the Judeo-Christian marriage. The man does not vow loyalty to his wife. Only the woman vows loyalty to her husband.
Yeah.
And if she's caught, or not even caught, if there's a suspicion, and she can be killed, and nobody goes to jail.
And it happens.
Yeah.
And it happens regularly.
Yeah, honor killing. That's
you ever see the stoning of
Soraya?
Soraya, yes.
It could be a suspicion, and everybody will sympathize with the husband and act like he's the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Men in the Muslim world, Sean, are burdened.
So women are treated like garbage. Women are treated, in many ways, are they slaves?
Well, the marriage contract is almost like a slave master relationship. And unfortunately,
they're sexual slaves?
Sexual slavery is allowed under Islamic law.
Yeah.
It's detailed in Sharia. There are pages and pages on slavery and sexual slavery, which was never abolished by Islam.
And women are not seen equally as their male counterparts under Sharia law. And you see this in Iran, you see this in Afghanistan, and you also now see it coming back on the table in Iraq with the Jafri personal status law. And what this is it's a, you know, 1,000-plus-year-old tradition of Sharia law where it permissibly allows a 9-year-old girl to be married. And it gives a male father and grandfather guardianship over females. Now, Iraq had a legal
And 9-year-old girls are sent off to be married, little children.
Child marriage is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. And what is the issue with the Prophet Muhammad on this?
There's debate, and there's debate, and there's different interpretations. But bottom line is that it should never be allowed.
Let me ask you this, because all of a sudden the Sultan of Brunei has an investment in this Beverly Hills Hotel, and I give credit to Leno and Ellen DeGeneres and those that have spoken out, Sharon Osbourne among them. This has been going on for as long as I have been in media, and we have discussed it, and I have taken a lot of heat for stepping up. In this country, the Democrats always claim that Republicans or conservatives are engaged in a war on women because they don't want to pay for their birth control pills, and maybe they are pro-life and they believe that life begins at conception. This is what you're describing is a real war on women, but yet women in this country have been on the left have been virtually silent. What is your reaction to that?
It's an insult to my intelligence. When I'm here in America, I escaped life in the Middle East to
in
come
Cairo.
To America.
And your father died fighting
the
Israelis.
Jihad, yes, in
yeah.
the jihad. Men's number one duty is not their families. Number one duty is to do jihad, to sacrifice their lives on
holy
jihad.
War.
Holy war. And I come to America, and I enjoyed this country. It took me years to... I never wore the hijab, but I had the hijab on my mind. It took me years in America to get rid of this oppression that I came with, the baggage I came with. And when 9/11 happened, a lot of Americans, Sean, asked, where are the Arab Americans to speak against jihad, about the oppression of women?
And
here I
forward.
Am. I stepped forward, and instead of being appreciated, even the feminists called me Islamophobe. How can it be a phobia? A phobia is unreasonable fear. I'm afraid of Sharia because under Sharia, I must be killed now. Anybody on
you are now
on.
You are officially apostate.
Absolutely.
And that means you would die by death.
And
they would feel justified in the minds of Allah.
There is a law in Sharia that says a Muslim will not be prosecuted if he kills an apostate. Anybody on the street can kill me.
And I wouldn't have the same opportunities and resources or be sitting here had I been living under Sharia.
And your parents, by the way.
My father is Afghan. My mother is Pakistani. And both countries are ruled by Sharia law. And my parents left to give us a better opportunity, chances to live our life freely with autonomy, to educate ourselves. And we're very grateful for that. And we would not have gotten that had we been living there.
Well, thank you for telling your stories. Thank you for educating people.
Thank you, Sean, for giving us a chance to speak out.
You're very welcome.
Because we love this country and we love the freedom it gave us. And we would like America to understand what we went through in order for America to prevent Sharia from penetrating this
country. Look what's happening in Europe right now.
In England.
And even in this country.
Yeah.
In some
we
part.
Escaped it.
Yeah.
And we don't want it to come here.
Well, there's a fear to identify radical Islam. Because then, quote, oh,
yes.
You're offending people.
You have to call it out for what it is. And there has to be a middle ground in that you can speak out and you can actually say, hey, you know what, this is wrong. Because it's not just a women's issue or an issue that's going on there.
It's a human
rights
issue.
It's a human rights issue.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And we have to be able to speak out without being condemned for it.
I challenge everybody on the left, speak out. You know, stop being a bunch of cowards. I've got to run here.
Revolution.
But you're
going to
join us tomorrow night, right?
Sure.
You're going to be here. We got a programming note.
Nani Darwish and Zainab Khan just back in May on Sean Hannity discussing a vital issue. You know, one of the things that Sean said I totally agree with is that this is the real war against women. We've heard this political debate about Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, talking about the issue of war against women. The real war is with the women I see every day on the Internet. The stories I listen to, the stories I read, these brave, courageous ladies trying their best to stand up against atrocities committed against them. Also, Zainab mentioned something we're going to discuss a little bit in a few minutes. It's about the issue of child brides. In the news, there's an Iranian child bride. She lives in Iran. Her name is Razia Ebrahami. She is facing execution for killing the man she was forced to marry. A little statistic on Razia. She was forced to marry at the age of 14. She became a mother at 15. And at 17, after much abuse psychologically and physically, she finally cracked, if you will, and killed her husband. Now, we don't justify the murder of someone else, but the point being there is a lot of things going on in Razia's situation that led to this. And now the very society that enforces child brides, the very culture that mandates child brides, is going to punish and kill the one who suffered under this atrocity. And so we need to speak up for Razia Ebrahami and many, many, many other child brides that are going through this situation. What I want to do right now, I want to introduce our guest with a little bit of a mini documentary, and then we're going to talk to her live. This is from the Honor Diaries film. We're going to introduce you to Zainab Khan, a little bit of information about her, and then we're going to get her live on the program, On the Cross in the Desert.
I sometimes look back and I think, wow, how different could my life have been had I been born in a different geographical setting, in a different time, in a different era, a different place on the map. It's just by chance. My father came here in the late 50s from Afghanistan. He wanted us to have the life that he never experienced. My mother was the same way. She didn't get to experience a lot of opportunities, choices, and the things that I have. So my parents lived vicariously through us and encouraged us to explore every opportunity we got, to live life, to experience things the way that they didn't get to. I'm a clinical therapist. I work primarily with women who are survivors of domestic violence. There's no self-esteem in these women. There's no self-worth. How do you weaken people or handicap them? You take away their ability to make decisions for themselves. You take away that ability for them to decide what is right and wrong. Autonomy, empowerment.
And there you heard it, a little bit of a mini documentary about our upcoming guest. Zainab Khan is a licensed clinical therapist for survivors of domestic violence, primarily among Asians. She's also an active participant in global women's rights. So she's an activist as well. And on the recent documentary Honor Diaries, she appeared with her story among the other 8 activist women. And she's also a fine, talented artist with paintings. I want to welcome right now to The Cross in the Desert, Zainab Khan. And Zainab, thank you so much for being patient and waiting and being a guest on our program today.
Randy, thank you so much for having me today and for covering this imperative issue. I know all the work that you do in regards to raising awareness of all of these things that are going on, which are, you know, so crucial, especially right now that you hear on the news and you keep seeing all these reports in the media of women that are undergoing these atrocious acts. And the sad thing is that this is not anything new.
Yes, women are breaking the silence for the first time. What really I like so much about this film is Muslim women are being suppressed a lot of times to keep these stories silent and secret, but with the internet today you can't do that. And they're speaking out against the atrocities committed against women, and they're breaking their silence. And I think that's some of the most positive things I've seen along this issue, that women are coming to the forefront like an honor diarist and speaking out against these things.
Absolutely. It's so powerful to see that this film has been a platform for women to speak out and speak up against some of the very, very atrocious acts that they had undergone. For example, Jaha had led a very successful campaign against female genital mutilation. The issue of child marriage has opened up, you know, doors where you have people that have watched the film and say, yeah, that happened to me, and I was a victim of this. And what has happened throughout all this time is that there's been this culture of fear that stops women from speaking out in fear of repercussions and fear of consequences and fear of being stigmatized. And now, you know, not just through the film, through the internet, our world is a lot more interconnected and transparent. So we can see what our experiences are and where the core issues lie, where these things are happening.
I mentioned some statistics, Zainab, in the beginning, and I mentioned there's 3,000 honor attacks reported in the UK. There's over 6,000 girls and women circumcised, 5,000 honor killings, and 60 million girls worldwide becoming child brides. And you, your organization, what you do as a speaker, a lecturer, is you're about empowering women through peace, love, respect, and mutual understanding. And I think your task, you can help me with this, is freeing women from oppression, patriarchal norms, tribal customs, twisted religion. You feel a calling to do something about this. And I think, like you said in the documentary, because you're born in this country here, and your parents came from Afghanistan, it could have been a lot different, but you have an opportunity here in a free society to speak up for these women.
Absolutely. I use this as a way where I use my empowerment to help others and to help people that do not have the same opportunities and resources that I have. And this is why it's so crucial to have women and men, as you mentioned earlier, to gather together and raise awareness and advocacy and lobby for change to help change these systems of laws that are in countries and societies that determine, you know, moral and ethical systems of governance against women to control them. And what is happening is that these laws are implemented against women and girls who do not follow the principles and guidelines of what they supposedly should be. And retaliation and settlement of accounts through century-old forms of violence are justified, whether through religion or through culture, and this needs to stop.
I think you said something I liked on the Honor Diaries page, a little bit about you, your bio. You used the term sisterhood. I like this because you were saying you cannot imagine remaining in a safe zone knowing that your sister may not be given the same resources or opportunities to live a life that is her own, free from barriers or restrictive norms. So you look at this as a sisterhood, empowering your sisters that are under attack like this, and I like that term.
Absolutely. You know, in today's day and age, there must be directive and decisive action to ensure that our world's girls and women have safety. You know, how are we taking preventative measures to ensure, you know, that girls are not kidnapped like they were in Nigeria in the middle of their night from dorm rooms, you know? How are we protecting women such as Maryam Ibrahimi that gave birth in a prison cell because and was jailed because of apostasy laws? You know, we must protect women, widows, daughters, sisters, mothers, wives, from becoming victims of institutionalized power that mandates control over self-serving lawmakers and governments in the quest of righteousness. And this is absolutely a human rights violation.
Exactly. Now, some of the things, the incidents that happen under the name of honor killings, for instance, I was looking at some statistics, and there was a lady named Heshu, and she's a victim of an honor killing. She was killed because she was dating a Christian, and being too Western, she was stabbed and her throat was cut. Another one, Sahani, she was raped, tortured, and burned by her classmates who considered her too Western. Give us a definition, really, that we can cling on to, really what's going on here in this honor and shame culture. What is honor according to these cultures? How do they define that term?
Every time I hear about something like this, it makes my stomach churn. You know, geographically, culturally, religiously, honor-based violence varies in degree of severity. Now, women living under such social traditions, the concept of being too westernized often results in, you know, an honor-based crime. And this could go into anything such as a choice of sexual or marital partner, education and employment, dating. Dating is a huge thing. Rejecting a forced marriage, interfaith relationships, leaving a spouse or seeking divorce, sexuality, dress code, basically any general conformity to the family and community's cultural expectations. If you break those, then those are considered to be so dishonorable that hence it challenges the collective identity and aims of the family. So there you have these acts that are committed, and then they're justified. They're justified because the woman is, dishonorable.
Now, one of the things I wanted to point out was that when you talk about honor killings, traditionally you're talking mainly about women as the victims. Have you ever come across men themselves that are the victims of honor killings, and so can you describe that?
I mean, I think that's going to be something that still needs to be, really, really reviewed, but honor killings for men in terms of their sexuality, their choice of partners, I'm sure that is a huge, huge problem, and it is yet to be uncovered. We are just scratching the surface with this right now, Randy. We're just this is just the beginning.
Yeah, I want to talk
sure
a little
that,
bit. Of, okay.
Sure,
go ahead.
No,
I was just going to say, I just wanted to follow up on that, and not to interrupt you there, but how successful has the education and awareness through Honor Diaries been? I mentioned before you came on that a lot of controversy from Muslim groups accusing you of being Islamophobic and things like that. Tell us the success, the pros and the cons so far of Honor Diaries.
The film has been a major success. I mean, we started the film in Chicago at the Chicago International Film Fest. And we're on a great track throughout U.S. campuses. There were a couple screenings that were censored by CHAIR. And, collectively we overcame them. And we showed that our voices will not be silenced. And just recently there was a very successful screening of Honor Diaries in Egypt. It was also screened in London at the U.K. Summit for Sexual Violence Against Women, where Angelina Jolie was present. So, There's a lot of movement and momentum still behind the film, because it's not just the film, it's the movement. And it's really rallying and gathering women throughout the globe to take action. And it's been an amazing journey, the film from having the salon 2 years ago where we sat, nine of us sat, and it was open. We could have talked about anything. And yet the core premise of the thing that we all had in common was the concept of honor-based violence that each of us had experienced either through people that we know or that had happened to us.
Now, one of the things I like about the film, Zainab, was the subtitle, that culture is no excuse for abuse. I think that's very catchy. It's very appropriate because oftentimes you've heard it, well, the reason why these incidents take place is because it's a cultural thing. And what Honor Diaries, and I think what you're saying very clearly, is that culture is never an excuse for abuse, is it?
Absolutely not. And just because it has been adopted and implemented and justified for centuries and still is, culture is no excuse for abuse. And it's about time that we break that paradigm. And this is what we're doing through the film, through dialogue, through advocacy, through lobbying, and through, you know, people rallying together to make it a point that this is not just something that culture should be protecting atrocious crimes that are being committed against women. This is a universal human rights issue, and we must put a stop to it.
Yes. Now, one of the things that happened in the film that really touched my heart, that I thought this is real progress, is there was an incident where one of the activists in the Honor Diaries, I think her name is Fahima Hashim, recounts how she, by merely presenting her uncle with a few informative pamphlets on the harmful risk linked to female genital mutilation, she was able to influence him and get him to think about this horrible practice. And that's what you're about, is to educate, is to get the information
Absolutely.
Out there and make a difference.
Absolutely. If Fahima had not provided her uncle with those pamphlets and with that education, then an entire new generation of girls would have been cut, and that tradition would have been continued on and on and onwards. And this is why it's so imperative to educate and to raise awareness and have this kind of a dialogue, because, to be honest, no change is going to ever come forth unless we actually understand where we are wrong in supporting such violent acts against women. That does not allow them to be equal counterparts to their, you know, to males. That gives them, you know, less freedom, less equality, where their movements are limited, where their sexuality is limited, where their piety is linked to being suppressed. All of this needs, you know, all of this requires education and dialogue for change to occur.
I was amazed at how many countries report these kinds of honor killings, these kinds of things committed against women. Canada, Great Britain, of course, the United States, Sweden, Germany, France, Bangladesh, Brazil, Ecuador, Egypt, India, Gaza, West Bank, Italy, Jordan, Pakistan, Morocco, Sweden, Turkey, Uganda, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran. This is a horrible epidemic out of control. It seems like just a mountain to move. Do you feel sometimes like this is an impossible task to overcome?
I feel like it's one of the highest mountains to climb, and I believe that Nazanin had mentioned something very powerful, that, you know, I am just one person. I am just one voice. And collectively, unifyingly, we are able to make that change. Now, change is possible. Change is very possible. Look at the advancement of women that we've had in the United States. We've overcome milestones. We've had great achievements. So while this concept, what you're discussing, Randy, you know, in India, Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, Malaysia is huge in, you know, gender-based violence also. Spreading awareness globally isn't going to be an easy task, but this is the start.
I agree with that. And when I see the mountain that we're up against, I know that the key is education and awareness. And you've written so many good pieces on this, and I wanted to focus a minute on this practice of child brides. It's hard for us as Western people to understand how a culture can allow something like this to go on. Now, in India, there are laws about this, but there have been some people that go beneath the system and still practice child brides. Tell us a little bit about this practice and what is going on and how we can do something to change that.
So, you know, child bride and child marriage is a huge problem. And what's happening is, when you zoom in on it, it affects other areas of global development, such as health, education, and economy. So girls become highly susceptible to sex trafficking, medical issues from early childhood birth, and then they are financially compromised, and then that's how you see female poverty, which is rampant in these. So what happens, child brides, so it's cultural, there's bride trade-off, there's, you know, girls are used traffickers, especially in Afghanistan, where there's a value of a girl in exchange for, you know, cattle, literally for cattle. And also what you're seeing now is that laws are being passed, okay, to stop and prevent child marriages, but the law holds no value or teeth. So tribal customs still trump over the laws that are passed. Or what you're going to see is the complete opposite. So, for example, in Iraq, the Jafri personal status law will now allow girls to be married at the age of 9. This is a complete reversal, where Iraq used to have the – Iraq was very progressive and had the legal age of marriage at age 18. So this is also a complete regression, you know, so you take one step forward and two steps back. And I think that key here is that governments also need to be accountable for holding on to these laws and making sure that human rights are not violated. Governments must be held accountable for this.
Exactly. I was reflecting before you came on about the case of Rezaia Ebrahimi in Iran. And Tor, can you imagine being forced to marry at the age of 14 and becoming a mother at 15? Women, are they really ready for something as radical as that at that young age?
It's so much trauma, Randy. I mean, from a clinician's perspective, I can tell you that is just complete post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, your body is physically, child marriage is rape. There's no consent in that. So you're traumatized, you're abused, you're bartered, you're traded, and then you're in this system where you're thrown in this vicious cycle where there's no way out. Any step that you take is going to sabotage you.
Yes, when
so
I think of the age of
there's
nine.
There's no form of protection. There's no form of advocacy. There's no form of, services that are being provided for such women and girls and children. I'm going to emphasize children because, to me, a 14-year-old is a child. Shouldn't be going off and getting married and supported. It's supported by your government. It's supported by your customs. It's supported by your societies, and that is just wrong.
Yes, in fact, they just passed a law in Iran not too long ago about the man of the family, the male of the family, can marry his cousin, a 13-year-old girl, child bride law passed in Iran. And when you were mentioning the age of 9, it just boggles the mind. But what I like about what you do so well with what you've done with Honor Diaries and using it as a platform, you've become a voice, literally, for the voiceless. And that is a huge task to undertake. But how does it feel, Zainab, to know that what you're saying and what you're educating, you're becoming a voice for people who can't speak up because of fear?
Thank you, Randy. And I absolutely say I encourage people to step up, speak out. And these roadblocks, you know, they're going to be there. You're going to have people that are going to point fingers and call and say whatever it is for their own self-serving agenda. But the bottom line, and I always bring it down to what it is, it's a human rights issue. It's a violation, a complete violation of human dignity, your right to live, your right to make choices, your right to self-autonomy. And this is where plain, simple, clean. It is absolutely wrong.
Exactly. Now, Zainab, tell us what is on the future for you. I know you do a lot of speaking engagements, and in fact, I've also seen some of your artwork, and just very, really, really beautiful artwork. And so you have, I think your artwork
Thank
is
you.
Kind of an escape, a little bit. You love to do it. It kind of takes the stress away from your demanding job and what you do, and then you kind of pour yourself into your artwork. It's kind of a relaxing thing to do with what you do, and you do so well at it. But tell us, what's on the agenda for this fall? What are you going to try to accomplish in the name of educating and making people aware?
Well, moving forward, I will be speaking at the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention, which is the birthplace of women's rights. And there we will actually be screening Honor Diaries as
Great.
Well as reading and signing the Declaration of Equalities for Muslim Women. which will be phenomenal. So I'm very, very excited about that. And we'll also be leading a panel, which will be called Redefining the Role of Muslim Women in the 21st Century. So I'm excited to share what that panel dialogue will bring about, because there's a lot to uncover, there's a lot to discuss, and there's a lot to be done.
Well, what I want to do is just ask you, in our closing minutes, we're talking about a vast subject. We're talking about a subject that is overwhelming to a lot of people, and they listen to this, and they, as a listener, are saying, what can I do to make a difference? This is just overwhelming. Please share with our listeners what practical steps women can make, just like you, to make a difference and change these laws and make awareness.
You can get involved in many different, there's so many different platforms online. You know, the film itself, honordiaries.com. You can visit the website, and there are several action items that you can take. You can sign. There's a violence against women law that's being, you know, trying to be passed internationally. Sign that, share it with, you know, your fellow congressmen where you live. Use social media as a powerful platform to write. Get your voice out there. Get your voice heard. It's going to be heard. And I also feel that spreading the word and sharing the message for unity and for universal equality and empowerment is crucial. So in terms of getting involved, I, especially through our day and age where we're interconnected through technology, there really are, you know, multiple platforms where you can get involved.
That's good, because the Internet is a very big place, and there are lots of organizations, as you mentioned. So really, we have an opportunity. We are really interconnected. And we are that sisterhood, as you mentioned, is we can get involved. And don't be so overwhelmed by this issue of human rights that you feel inadequate to do something. You made a decision because of where you live. You're going to do something to empower women. And that would be, I think, your message to those listening.
Absolutely. And I also always say this, Randy, it's not a point of it being my cause or your cause or their cause, or a cause that's separate because it's going on in a different part of the world. No, this is all of us. This is something that we all can take a part of. This is a change that we all can be a part of a movement. So that's something that I always say, you know, in screenings and my talks as well, that this is a universal issue and everybody's voice counts.
Exactly, exactly. Well, those are some really good words, some really good closing words. Zainab, I wish we had more time. I know you probably have a lot more to share, and I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule and educating us. And thank you so much for being on The Cross in the Desert. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you so much for covering this, and I look forward to hearing the link.
All right. Thank you, Zainab. That is Zainab Khan, and she is a clinical licensed therapist from Chicago involved with educating and empowering women about the issue of human rights through honor killings and all of the things that are happening that are atrocious. But she's making a difference in our world. What I like about Zainab is that she wants us all to be involved. It's not just her cause or my cause. It's our cause, and that's so appropriate because oftentimes we tend to think, well, it's that person's cause, and they're more qualified than me, or things like that. But no, as she mentioned, it's a universal issue, and we can make a difference through education and awareness. Thank you so much, Zainab, for educating us today on The Cross in the Desert. I want to play an appropriate song for all of this, and when you hear about the misery and the tragedy and the things that are going on in the world, you think about the wounds and the scars that are left by these atrocities, by these honor killings. People are genuinely shattered. People are hurt. But this is a song of hope, when you can find healing and forgiveness and restoration. And this is a song by Michael W. Smith called Come See. I think the words pretty much will tell you the story of what you can do to get the scars in your life healed. So let's listen to it right now on The Cross in the Desert.
door is open, come near. Come weary and ashamed, come near. His arms are open, his arms are open.
Of worship from one of my favorite artists in the contemporary Christian music field, that is Michael W. Smith. That is a song I think that needs to be played more often. I know that in a lot of his concerts he has a ton of material. I want to see that song played more. It is a song of hope and healing. And I have a couple questions for you this morning. What is your concept of God this morning? And do you see God as angry and judgmental, holding you accountable, or do you see a God with his arms wide open? And I can only tell you the story I've said many times about the concept of God. My friend, she's an Iranian girl that lives in Mashhad, Iran, and we Skype a lot and talk a lot. She's a part-time English teacher, and she was recently married. But she was recounting a time in her growing up, if you will, when she went to school in Iran. And, of course, in Iran, there are many, many laws. One of them is the wearing of a hijab to be veiled. And her teacher told the class, look, here's what's going to happen if you don't wear your hijab properly, if you don't wear it at all, that in the judgment, Allah is going to dangle you over the fires of hell by your hair. Well, that concept of what Allah was going to do with my friend stayed with her. But through the wonderful, wonderful technology of the Internet, my friend began to come upon stories and articles and songs that talked about a different concept of God, one of loving, one of mercy. And as we were talking, she mentioned this to me. And, of course, I share my Christian faith with her in a very polite way because my friend is used to hearing 24 hours a day judgment and hell where she lives. And so I'm very cautious about how I share my faith. It needs to be done in a respectful way because of what my friends endure every day. And so I was sharing with her about this song I just played for you, and she just loves it. The words are a source of healing to her. The chains are broken. His arms are open. I hope that brings some healing and hope to you today. For the many traumas and the scars in your life that you feel just hopelessly trapped because of, the oppression, the fear, whatever it may be, God is a God of infinite mercy and love, and his arms are wide open. And I hope that today, that if you have this concept of God, of judgment, I hope that you will have a concept of his arms open wide. I'm thinking of the many, many victims of this violence that Zainab and I talked about today. Living in the countries they live, they might be able to somehow break from their families and break away from what they've endured, but that scar, that hurt, that trauma is still with them, and they still somehow are in a prison. They may have broken away from the family, may have gotten even out of the culture, but they still feel trapped in this prison with so many scars. God says, come to me, you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. And when we come to him, it's that image of the Father reaching out with his arms. One of my favorite parables that Jesus taught was the parable of the prodigal son. And the prodigal son demanded his inheritance now. He wanted to split, if you will, and go spend it all on his luxurious living. The father willingly gave him his inheritance, and the son took off to a far country, the Bible says. Well, one day he reached the end. Everything he had spent on luxurious living, he ended up like in a pigsty. And he realized that all of this money that was given to him, his inheritance, he had spent it all on himself and wasted away, and now he wanted to back home. But he realized, my father will not accept me. I have taken my inheritance, which was mine, but I've spent it and I've wasted it, and I'm at the end of my life. You know what? I will just go back and be one of his servants, he said. At least I'll go back home. So one day, he had an experience that changed his life. And Jesus talked about his father saw his son in the distance, and he ran to his son with his arms wide open. And when he embraced his son and kissed him, he said to his servants, we're going to have a party. Kill the fattened calf. My son was dead, and now he's alive. He was lost, and now he is found. And this was the story that Jesus taught. The religious leaders surrounding him, and I'm sure this is one of the reasons he told this parable, they were enraged. Think about Modest's concept of God, my friend. who lives in Iran. They expected God to judge this man for what he had done, and Jesus was saying the opposite, that he loved, forgave, and welcomed him back to the family. The religious leaders were offended that Jesus didn't talk about a judgmental God. And instead, he talked about a God of infinite love and mercy. So I ask you, your concept of God is today. And I hope that Michael W. Smith's song and the story that Jesus told about the prodigal son will help inform you and help you to see God, to see the real picture of who he is instead of the distorted picture that is often all the time presented about him. I want to share with you a very special speech from a girl, a young Muslim girl that is so exciting. And she is really my hero in many, many ways. I'm talking about Malala Yousafzai, the young Pakistani Muslim girl who a couple of years ago was gunned down by the Taliban and left for dead simply because she spoke up for every girl should have an opportunity for education. And the Taliban doesn't believe in women being educated. Yet this young, courageous girl stood up. She recovered from this serious head wound. And she wrote a book called I Am Malala. But before that book came out, she made an amazing speech at the United Nations, one of the most incredible speeches I've really ever heard. So I want to share this with you because this is about a woman, a young lady, who is empowered. Like Zainab talked about, empowering women, educating women, Malala is a great example of a courageous lady, a young lady, who is unafraid of circumstances, unafraid of terrorists, who is unafraid and wants to put her voice out there for women to be educated, to get an education, to be free, to be empowered. So I want you to hear Malala's speech at the United Nations. In fact, I believe this was exactly a year ago. So we're going to listen to it right now on the cross in the desert.
The words the Taliban never wanted her to hear. Happy 16th birthday, Malala.
Being here with such honorable people is a great moment in my life. And it's an honor for me that today I'm wearing a shawl of Benazir Bhutto Shahid. I cannot believe how much love people have shown me. Malala Day is not my day. Today is the day of every woman, every boy, and every girl who have raised their voice for their rights. So here I stand. So here I stand, one girl among many. I speak not for myself, but for those without voice can be heard. On the 9th of October 2012, the Taliban shot me on the left side of my forehead. They shot my friends too. They thought that the bullet would silence us. But they failed. Weakness, fear, and hopelessness died. Strength, power, and courage was born. I do not even hate the Talib who shot me. Even if there is a gun in my hand and he stands in front of me, I would not shoot him. Be peaceful and love everyone. We realize the importance of our voice when we are silenced. In the same way, when we were in Swat, the north of Pakistan, we realized the importance of pens and books when we saw the guns. The terrorists are misusing the name of Islam and Pashtun society for their own personal benefits. Islam says it's not only each child's right to get education, rather it's their duty and responsibility. There was a time when women social activists asked men to stand up for their rights, but this time We will do it by ourselves. I'm not telling men to step away from speaking for women's rights. Rather, I'm focusing on women to be independent, to fight for themselves. So today, we call upon the world leaders to change their strategic policies in favor of peace and prosperity, that all the peace deals must protect women's and children's rights. A deal that goes against the rights of women is unacceptable. We call upon all governments to ensure free, compulsory education all over the world for every child. We cannot all succeed when half of us are held back. Our words can change the whole world. We are all together, united for the cause of education. Let us empower ourselves with the weapon of knowledge. And let us shield ourselves with unity and togetherness. Let us pick up our books and our pens. They are our most powerful weapons. One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world. Education is the only solution. Education first. Thank you.
What a powerful voice. I remember there's a longer speech. This is just the popular segments of the speech, just the outtakes, if you will. This was an amazing speech, one that I will never forget. It reminds me of the words of Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address, in which he lamented the bloody cause of the Civil War, and he contained an unforgettable phrase that government of the people, by the people, and for the people will never perish from the earth. These are unforgettable words from President Lincoln about what true government is about, and it reminds me of the speech that JFK challenged the Americans with. Remember that speech back in 1961, I believe, where he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what can you can do for your country. And then you think of Martin Luther King's famous speech when the racial war was going on so heavily in 1963. He declared to a nation torn apart by racism, I have a dream. Words are really powerful. Words can change the destiny of our lives. And this is what this speech has done for me. It has really changed my whole perception of what can be done through powerful words and powerful speeches like the one that Malala gave. And it was actually on July 12, 2013, on her 16th birthday. She's such a young lady, and she's making such a difference in the world. And those speeches remain in my mind. Here's the famous phrase. Government is of the people and by the people and for the people, President Lincoln. Ask not what you can do for your country. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, JFK. And then the famous words from Malala, one book and one pen can change the world. I love that. It resonates with me. That's a speech to remember. One book and one pen can change the world. If you go to her Facebook page, I love what's on her page because there's a quote at the top from the book I Am Malala, and the quote is from UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He says, extremists have shown what frightens them the most, a girl with a book. Great, great quote, because that's the truth. That's why Malala was shot. And, you know, women face incredible barriers across the world. They do. We talked about this morning. But they are also the greatest hope the world has, the biggest asset, women. Shahzad Shahid on Malala's page says, "We hope to inspire women by living our own lives with courage and authenticity, and by creating programs through the Malala Fund that invest in the education of young girls so that when they become women, they have the self-confidence and skills to overcome what may come their way." Shahzad Shahid on Malala's Facebook page. If you've never read this book, please take the time to do so. It is a great book. And it is called I Am Malala. She is a voice, if you will, in the wilderness. And she is calling upon us to do what she has done. And don't be afraid, but to speak up. It is an amazing book, and how one girl stood up for education and changed the world. Malala Yousafzai, tremendous, courageous girl. Thinking about our subject today and reflecting on the interview I had with Zainab, I want to talk to you on a personal level about a friend I have, an Iranian friend. Her name is Nasim, and she lives in Tehran, and she has traveled to India. She is getting her master's degree in women's studies and women's rights. She is also an activist, and she has dedicated her life in the best way she can by traveling abroad to educate others about these issues that Zainab and I spoke about today. And she's become a good friend, and we've chatted back and forth, emailed back and forth. She really supports what I do here on the Cross in the Desert. And one day, as we were chatting, she was sharing with me a story I didn't know. She was sharing with me a story about her sister, and she shared with me the details about her sister and what happened. And I said to Nasim, I said, you know, I need to write something about this. I need to talk about this, because we don't often know that the suicide rate in Iran is great. Because of the society they live in, the pressure, the male-dominant society, there are a lot of young girls who find out that they don't want to cope with this situation. And so they plan to exit from that situation. A lot of them commit suicide. And it's very, very sad. And what I want to do is spend a little bit of time this morning before our program is over to read to you a blog I wrote about her sister in dedication to her life. You may have never heard about her before, but I'm trying to put a face on Nasim's sister. And so I hope you'll just allow me to read this blog. It's called The Death in Borjazan, Remembering Shabnam. It begins with kind of a poem from Scarlet Tears by Coran Darling. Fire ablaze within my eyes, a smile concealing all my lies, screaming, begging, calling out, a final frantic, desperate shout. They'll say I died of suicide, but no one knows how much they've lied. It wasn't a rope, a blade, or pills that broke my soul and gave me chills. I died inside so long before, to live each day an endless chore. Pill could not kill what was already dead, a twisted soul, an empty head. Luchetti is a 1967 French film directed by Robert Bresson and starring Nadine Nordier and Jean-Claude Gilbert. Nadine stars as a young, troubled teenage girl named Luchette, the daughter of a bullying, alcoholic father and an ailing mother living in an isolated French village. Luchette's life is filled with both tragedy and cruelty, spending her entire day caring for her infant brother and bedridden mother. At school, she is constantly, continuously mocked by her classmates and humiliated by her teacher when she sings off-key. One eventful day, while walking home from school, her life is changed forever. She gets lost in the woods during a violent storm and seeks shelter at a nearby home. The owner of the home, Arseny, is an epileptic alcoholic that takes Mouchetti in from the storm and then schemes to use her in covering up the murder of a man he had a fight with. After Mouchetti agrees to help Arseny by repeating a cover story that absolves him of the blame, he then rapes her. Later on, she reluctantly tells the cover story and explains that on the night of the murder, she was with her lover Arseny, giving him the perfect alibi. Mouchetti eventually returns home, filled with shame and humiliation, only to find her mother's conditioning worsening. Sadly, a few days later, her mother dies, and Mouchetti is devastated. Unable to cope with her grief and humiliation, Musetti goes to a nearby lake and drowns herself. Suicide. All too common. Sad ending to the lives of teenagers all over the world whose lives are broken from shame, guilt, and misery. In Iran, suicide is the second leading cause of death. The major contributing factor to the suicide epidemic in Iran among the youth is the strict government suspension, supervision that leads to fear and oppression, and an overall sense of hopelessness. The main victims of suicide in Iran are young women. In the Islamic society of Iran, women are viewed as subservient to men. The Quran, Islam's holy book, proclaims that, quote, men have authority over women because God has made the one superior to the other, Surah 434. Therefore, the woman is treated more like a possession of the man, relegated to the role of little more than a housewife and a mother who has no expectations of becoming really anything more. The superior male worldview in the Islamic society is very oppressive to the woman. Actually, the Quran teaches that a man can inherit twice as much as the female, Surah chapter 4, verse 11. He can beat his wife if he suspects her of adultery, Surah chapter 4, verse 35, and can marry up to four women. In contrast, the woman must ask permission from her husband to leave home and is forbidden from traveling alone. She is little more in this context, and in this worldview at least, little more than a slave of possession. In public, she is required to wear a hijab. And if the morality police discover she's showing too much skin or wearing excessive makeup, she will be arrested and retained at the police station until a significant bail is posted for her release. Shabnam Basiri, a 14-year-old teenager, full of life, full of great expectations and dreams, was born into this kind of society. In Borzistan, located in the south of Iran, that's where she was born, Shabnam was really like any other ordinary teenage girl, vibrant, full of life to realize all of her dreams, and yet underneath her smile was an inner pain, a troubled soul, a deep despair. She witnessed the religious hypocrisy all around her and considered what her life would eventually become because of living in a male-dominated society. Reflecting on the destiny and the fate of her life, Shabnam felt hopeless and trapped and decided to commit suicide rather than to be another victim of female oppression. Like many other women in Iran had done before her, she set herself on fire, protesting against the dictatorship of the Islamic regime. Saddened and broken by her death, Shabnam's classmates laid flowers on her desk at school for several weeks as a tribute to her life. Despite all of the sorrow and pain surrounding her, Shabnam found solace and comfort in the poems of Ahmed Shamlou. He's an Iranian poet of liberty who was a humanist with a hope and a passion for justice. One of his most well-known poems, Ada in the Mirror, is beautifully inscribed on Shabnam's gravestone, a lovely tribute to a young teenage girl whose life was tragically cut short because of an oppressive society's archaic and medieval treatment of women. In the midst of this painful tragedy in the Sim, Shabnam's beautiful sister now carries the torch for women's rights through writing articles and speaking out. She has become a voice for impoverished and suppressed women in India and all over the world, working tirelessly to improve their societal situation. There are many Shabnams in the world crying out for our help, desperate for someone to hear their voices. This is the reason why I wrote the book, The Rose of Nowruz, Dreams of Hope and Freedom. My book is based on the stories and experiences of my friends in Iran, struggling for hope and freedom in a society just like the one that Shabnam grew up in. The suicide rate among women in Iran is frightening. There is a brokenness, a hopelessness, and a despair that is tormenting the soul of every young woman. Their only desire is to grow up normally and realize their dreams through hard work and education. Who hears the cries of the Shabnams of the world? Who is willing to listen? Well, I know one person who does hear, and he does listen. He is near to the brokenhearted, and he saves the crushed in spirit. His name is Jesus. He says, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest." I remember writing this and trying to visualize just the pain that this young girl was going through. And as Zainab mentioned to us in our interview, she was fortunate to not be born in a society like that. Her life has been very different because she was born here. And I was thinking, what if I had been born there? What if I were in her place as a woman? I can't imagine the pain. She had no expectations. She had no hope. And some of us may be a little critical and judgmental by the way she ended her life. But before we become critical, we need to put ourselves in her shoes, in her place, and understand she had no hope. She had no reason to live. She felt, if I try to achieve things there, I will be stopped. Now, I know there are many women that have many good jobs in Iran, and they are pursuing their education, but that's not always the norm in every case and in every situation. So let's remember the Shabnams of the world today. Let's remember those that we've talked about today that are victims of incredible injustice and violence in the world today. Let us remember, though, that there are the Malalas who rise above their circumstances and stand unafraid, looking in the face of their accusers and tormentors and saying, "I will not be afraid of you. I'm going to make a difference." Let's, instead of have a sense of hopelessness, let's have hope and courage. And let's educate and make people aware. I really, really want to thank Zainab Khan for educating us today and for the hard work that she does all year round to make a difference in the lives of oppressed women. And I want to thank you for spending time with me this morning. Just come to my Facebook page, Randy L. Noble, and leave a comment and a suggestion. I have many articles there about the happenings in Iran and many things, many petitions that you can sign to make a difference in the lives of political prisoners. I really appreciate you spending your Monday day with me. I hope that you have an incredible week. And I want to say God bless you, and I will see you very soon again on the next Cross in the Desert. Goodbye for now.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong. It's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy.